It started as an experiment at first. Discussions in comic book shops, reviews in magazines. And then, that wonderful day, that great, glorious day, the internet. Yes, the internet gave us power, power, power to rule. Zack Snyder, Joel Schumacher, Tim Burton, clever, they have the brain of maggots, of tapeworms compared to ours. No, we have the power, power to rule, power to make the studios grovel at our feet. They're all frightened of us. Even the moon is frightened of us. Frightened. The gentlemen nerds are gathering to talk about power, power that we have over the studios and genre properties. Here gathered at the Lobot Lounge is Mark Finn.
It's like an omen. I shall become a fan.
Aaron Diorive.
Spectacular. Bravo. That is fantastic.
And I am Jack Griffin. No, I'm not. I'm Joseph Fotinos, and I'm your host and emotional touchstone for the Gentleman Nerds. Unfortunately, those of you who are regular podcast listeners to our show, we do have a nerd MIA. And unfortunately, Mr. Mickey Finn is having some technical difficulties, but hopefully he will join us later.
I'm sure he'll complain about it on the internet, and lots of nerd rage will be generated.
And speaking of which...
Yes! Tonight's topic, ladies and gentlemen, in case you haven't gathered, is the power that fans have now. It is amazing, and this power can be abused, and it can be a good thing. We have a voice, and the studios are very, very attuned to listening to us, especially with genre properties, superhero shows, science fiction, even horror. The fan feedback is enormous, and the fact that Comic-Con, San Diego Comic-Con, started as this tiny little convention and grew into this massive thing is proof positive that the studios know where their bread is buttered on,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
So now here we are. We're facing a generation of people who can go online and anonymously critique and criticize, and I think Harry Knowles made a career out of this, to let fans know, hey, I'm on your side, to be a mouthpiece for the fans and say, I read that comic book, and that's not right. But is that right? Is it really right?
Yeah, these are very amazing times that we live in. We do have an unprecedented amount of influence over these movies, these properties, and they are listening. Network TV is listening. Hollywood is listening. The pay cable channels are listening. And we were just talking about earlier where before, in the old days, you know, they were going to cancel a Star Trek show. Then people did a letter writing campaign, and they would gather as many letters as they could, and they would send them in to whatever the network is that was considering canceling the show. And if they were lucky, the show would not be canceled. And if they weren't, then the show was canceled, and oh well. Now we exist in a time where people can complain about or exclaim their love for something, and fans can get onto various social media sites and be activists and mm-hmm. proclaim their admiration for this and how much they want it. And now there are entities that will buy canceled shows from other individuals, from another network, from a rival channel, and they will save that show, Netflix, of course, being the prime example.
Oh, yeah.
And so now, if a show's about to be canceled, hey, no problem. Let's Netflix, are you interested in acquiring the mm-hmm. show? And they might say yes, because they know they have a built-in audience. They've seen the social media sites. They know the viewers that they're going to get for this show. And so they cough up the several hundred million dollars that are mm-hmm. necessary to acquire the beloved program. And now it has extended life. And That's amazing to me. It is amazing to me that we have
it's
that.
It's very amazing to me. I would like to be slightly contrarian regarding mm-hmm. this topic, or maybe perhaps the way in which I'm framing this for my own discussion purposes. Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree with you that with great fandom power comes great fandom responsibility. I also know that fandom is a superstitious and cowardly lot. and I say this as someone who all three of us are of the same approximate age, that we grew up with the computer. And so we got to see all this stuff developing firsthand. We're first generation computer users, all of us.
Yeah.
And that starts out with the bulletin boards. For just a second there, I was Canadian. That starts out with the bulletin boards where we're leaving messages. Then it became the groups, and now it's this massive
chat rooms.
Yeah, the chat rooms, and now it's this massive online presence. I agree with what you're saying that the studios are listening to fans. My caveat is up to a certain point. There were times when they listened to people a lot more fervently and cared a lot more what people thought, which is why the Lost ending is so borked. And Joseph and I we're not going to let that drop, ladies and gentlemen.
Never. Put the carrot in the hole. Put the carrot in the hole.
There was a time when people were really paying attention to the online fan community. And I know that the reaction from the Lost showrunners was that they felt that since it got guessed early on that they couldn't go that way. And of course, I think 6 years later they realized, no, actually we can. Because, if you put a million monkeys, if you put an infinite number of monkeys in a room, banging on typewriters, one of them is going to bang out the complete works of Shakespeare. So is it with fans and theories and shows.
Yeah. Interestingly, George R. R. Martin has gone on record as saying that he refuses to do that. I mean, there are people, he's already said this, that have guessed exactly how the Game of Thrones is going to end.
Right.
And he's not going to change it because they figured it out.
Yeah,
that would be silly. That would ruin his plan.
Yeah. That's part of the fun, though, isn't it?
Yeah. You got to let that one guy have his moment, right?
Well, exactly. Let's hypothesize is to say, oh, by the way, Mark, there's an infinite number of monkeys around here who want to talk to you about a script for Hamlet they've worked out. but that's the fun part about fandom is saying, oh, wow, I would love to see this. I mean, you nailed Force Awakens talking about Solo. And you were like, I bet this is going to happen. And we are like, yeah, maybe, maybe not. And I was like, nah. But, it's fun to go, that was me. It was my idea.
Yeah,
I got that, Hey, look
who's
here.
By the way, Mickey has joined
Welcome.
Us.
Welcome.
Hello. My car to get here is driven by Windows 10, who randomly decides to crash until I get a new model. So.
Well, we've ordered you your drink. It's right there.
Yes. Okay. We have.
Hang Galactic Cargo Blaster.
And only two of those
now. Yeah. Remember what happened last time.
Large gold brick lemon, come on.
I'm still shaving my feet from that one.
I know. But what I was mentioning earlier about power, I mentioned Harry Knowles by name because I think it's important to note that Ain't It Cool News got its big push or its big claim to fame, as Harry would like to say, by his critique of the Batman and Robin script. I remember that was a huge deal that he trashed the script on this little – and the guy started the website, for those of you that don't know. He hurt his back doing a Citywide's garage sale. A cart rolled over on him, and he was laid up in bed. He had nothing to do, so he started a website, and he started typing his opinion. That's all he did. He started typing his opinion. I used to go to the Citywide garage sales and talk with Harry about movies, and he'd give me his opinion, and then I'd give him my opinion. He was this cool guy. He talked about movies. He was fun. Yeah. Now he's sitting there just typing away, and somehow he always had a lot of insider information, so he always got to manage to see a script or hear treatment or something like that because he had lots of people in the industry that he knew from years and years and years ago. So he writes this scathing review of the Batman and Robin script, and the studios basically didn't care. But when it came out, and it was, Batman and Robin, I think that he gained a lot of legitimacy there. And people turned to him and said, you were right. Oh, my gosh. Tell us more.
Yeah.
And the studios went, crap, he said this, and it was true. Now we have to pay attention.
Yes. Right.
There was something about the power of the spoken word and the review, especially coming from a quote-unquote mega fan who says, you are disrespecting the property. You didn't give us what you wanted. Now let's segue back into Batman versus Superman. Because remember, our discussion there was, why can't people have different interpretations? Why can't the Batsuit have nipples on it? Why can't all the guns in Gotham City have neon on it? Why can't they?
Right.
I mean, really, do we want to give the power to the fans that much?
Let me just say, as someone who writes creatively and has been paid for his work, and has built larger worlds. This actually frames how I feel about everything that we're going to be talking about. For my 9 to 11 fans out there who follow me on social media and buy my books and love it when I write comics and always have nice things to say about my stuff. I owe them one thing and one thing only. My best work.
Amen.
I do not owe them an explanation. And if I can give them my best work and satisfy myself as an artist, then that's when we win.
And show up to readings with donuts.
That always helps.
Because I think they're expecting that now.
Well,
you've created a monster.
I've done mimosas before, too.
Yes, but, yes. No, Mark's readings are always worth attending.
I was going to say. That's
but no, I agree with you, Mark, 100%.
Yeah,
100%.
Everything else is kind of window dressing, frankly. And your reaction to my work is just that, yours and yours alone. I did not engender a reaction. I did not foment an emotional response. You mm-hmm. respond to it how you're going to respond to it. If we're lucky, the amount of energy that I put into this project to try and bring about an emotional response from you, hopefully it matches your response. If I wanted you to feel elated and maybe a little bittersweet at the end and sort of wistfully hopeful for the future, and you come away going, yeah, that wasn't what I thought it was going to be, but I really liked it. I'm kind of sad, mm-hmm. but I see where it's going. Then touchdown, everybody wins. Yeah. But to borrow a phrase that's currently floating around in the popular culture, if you come back at me with, nice going, asshole, you raped my childhood,
mm-hmm.
that's on you.
Right. Yeah. Right. No, absolutely. Yeah.
I am not responsible for anybody else's nervous breakdown.
There's a rule in improvisational comedy, which I did for many years, and I applied this rule to the TV show when I hosted Horror Films, and everyone had their own idea of what that should be. But to me, and this was the most important thing, and what you said, Mark, is parallel to this, play to the top of your intelligence.
Oh, nice.
And the audience will catch up.
Yes, good.
Don't candy it.
No lowest common denominator.
Right. Well, don't. No. You have to toss out the references. Do the best, as you said, the best work you can.
Yeah.
And they will catch up. They will. It just takes – what was that? Was that a reference to something? I don't understand. Why is he saying that? What's going on? You know, just do the show that you would like to see.
It's like a scavenger hunt. You get enough references out there, and people have to look stuff up.
And that's fun. It can be fun. But regardless of what the project is, if it's a role-playing game or a novel or a TV show or a movie, whatever it is, if you do it the best you can, and it's, again, do the thing that you want, do what you want.
Right.
And then if you find like minds that say, yes, brilliant. Now, here's where I will say, there's something to this. And we talk about an established property. If you create your property from scratch, if you create your universe, that is your universe. You can make the rules and break them. It is your universe.
Yes.
But if you now say, now I'm going to take on Buckaroo Banzai, and I'm going to do a Buckaroo Banzai film. And in this film, Buckaroo Banzai is female. And not only is she female, Buckaroo Banzai is the president of the United States, and Buckaroo Banzai is an android. Go.
Okay.
And the fan world goes, what?
My caveat to this is, you still owe them your best work, but you're not in the service of the fans, you're in the service of the property. You owe the property
your best
work.
Right. Okay. But here's the thing too, and even then, by the way, you know, as Joseph pointed out, well, if you created it, it's your own universe. Yeah, tell that to George Lucas.
it gets really big. Yeah.
Yeah, even George Lucas was told essentially by some fans, you cannot change.
Yeah.
You cannot give us your version of Star Wars. We reject that. We want our version.
That's very true.
Of Star
the
Wars.
Youngling.
And so it becomes one of those really delicate. It's a very fine line that you have to walk as a creator. Again, also as an artist and as someone who understands how difficult it is to make a film, even a low budget film, let alone something that these behemoths that cost, you know, $200 million,
sure.
Or how difficult it is to write a novel, or how difficult it is to do anything. You know, I want to give the artist the freedom to give me their best work. And then I want to look at it and I want to try to understand what this artist was trying to do. I want to appreciate what this artist has attempted to do. Maybe, in my opinion, maybe they missed the mark. They didn't quite get there. They had the opposite effect of maybe what I thought they wanted to do. And that's fine. I'm as entitled to my opinion as somebody who receives this as the artist is entitled to his interpretation.
Well, that's beautifully said, and it should be pointed out to our listeners that all four of us are creative class individuals. We've all created things. We've written stories. We've produced shows. We've done video games. We've done scripts. So all of us have done this, and so we're coming at this from the point of view of someone who, anytime, because I don't know about you guys, but you know, I basically watch all media in two modes. I either watch, I turn my brain off and enjoy the story, or I watch it to take it apart, see how they made the sausage.
Right.
Yeah.
And where this differs from the kind of histrionic, vituperous, bile spewing rage that I see online all the time now.
More and more, yeah.
That you have a number of fans, many of whom are young, under the age of 18, many of whom are male, many of whom are probably registering somewhere on the autism spectrum, and they may
be
much like some of the creators.
I do not say this lightly. But I'm being deadly serious now. There's probably some ADHD going on here, and I guarantee you there is a lack of empathy such as you find in some places on the autism spectrum. There's a lack of emotional empathy and a lack of emotional intelligence.
Certainly there is a lack of emotional maturity, yes.
Yes, I think that comes from the anonymity of the internet, though. I wouldn't say that vitriolic fans are autistic.
No, I didn't mean to make that sweep generalization.
Right.
Yeah, and it should point out before we get the letters that Mark isn't necessarily saying that, you know, autism bad. It's a factor for what causes some of this.
I think you're right.
The emotional immaturity is, I think, what we're all zeroing in on, is that there's a difference between somebody saying, you know, I didn't care for that. That's fine. That's a reasoned, adult, rational response. And then there's, oh my God, I hated that, and I hope the creator dies.
I hope your dog gets cancer, you know.
Yes.
Right. Well, didn't they threaten, what's his name, James Gunn's animal or his dog or something like that?
Yeah,
recently some fan was crazy about that.
They threatened the writer of Captain America, who decided to make him a Hydra agent.
And,
they threatened everybody. Right now,
on breaking news, the new Harry Potter play, which is happening right now, Hermione in the play has been cast as a black actress who is quite the award-winning actress, in fact. Yeah. And the fan base is freaking out because they've made Hermione black.
No, right. Never mind the fact that Hamilton, which is the gigantic behemoth, hugest Broadway hit ever, has cast a majority of the American Revolutionary characters as black.
Yes.
Yeah.
And nobody says a word.
Yeah, right. Latinos.
Nobody cares.
Because they're not geeky.
Right.
Well,
but here's the thing.
Geeks are my people.
It changed at some point, right? You know, if we're talking about Shakespeare, people almost expect, maybe it's age, maybe it's how old the property is. If you're talking about Shakespeare, people expect that you're going to have wildly different interpretations of Shakespeare, where in some Hamlet can be a woman. You know,
In some versions, Keanu can act.
Right, or you know, you could have Othello, where he's white and everybody else around him is black.
Right.
Or you could have Othello, and they cast them all as women, and it's a female gang called Switchblade Sisters by Jack Hill. You should check it out.
Right. And so, you see, that's accepted. People are like, oh yeah, you know, I'm going to go see this interpretation of Shakespeare, Midsummer Night's Dream. You know, which by the way, one of my favorite movies, Bachelor Party with Tom Hanks.
I love that movie.
It is Midsummer Night's Dream. Yes, it is Midsummer Night's Dream.
I actually have to see the movie. Thanks.
Yeah. You do. And when you see it, you're going to go, oh my, how did I not catch that?
I didn't see it the first time.
Right. So we're okay with Shakespeare, that happening to Shakespeare. We're okay with, on some extent, that happening to other classic works. Well, what if Dracula was a female character? What if we completely switched up the genders of Frankenstein? Or what if we set Frankenstein in a totally different country or a totally different time? We're okay with that. But my God, you go and you make Superman a guy that has a little bit of angst. And people lose their shit. Superman, he can't have angst? What are you talking about?
Or you make
about?
Captain America a Hydra agent.
Yeah,
let's compare this, because what we're talking about is religion. We're talking about the new aesthetic. Mm-hmm. We're talking about religion. In some of these things, Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, Captain America, they are the new pantheon of gods, and these people are revered and treated very seriously. It's like when they made The Last Temptation of Christ, and then suddenly, you know, Salman Rushdie had to go in hiding because his life was threatened, because in the novel, Jesus gets married and has kids. No. You can't do that. Of course, if you read the book, you'd know it really didn't happen. But anyway,
if you saw the movie, you'd know that it didn't happen.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Just know it. The movie's called The Last Temptation of Christ. Come on.
It's a temptation.
Anyway, yeah.
Not the final missing 10 years.
No, it's not.
Yeah, Jesus,
the college
Jesus,
10 years later. Yeah. Yeah.
I need to clarify something. Salman Rushdie? Did he write The Last Temptation of Christ?
No, Satanic Bibles. I'm sorry.
Right, okay.
Satanic
Verses. Yeah.
Satanic Verses.
Yeah.
Somebody else wrote The Last Temptation of Christ. I apologize.
I think
yes. Yes, he was. I can't remember who he is.
I think you put your finger on it earlier when you invoked the dreaded internet.
Yeah.
I think it's the internet that's really the issue here. There's a number of studies that have shown the corollary between people who are spending time online, they're losing some of their humanity. Because what it's doing is that anonymous, impersonal, constant interaction mimics the behavior of sociopathic individuals.
Right. Yes.
And the problem, and you know, specifically this lack of empathy and this sort of dispassionate interest in, you know, this Schadenfreude kind of manifestation, you know, we'd rather watch a car crash. The internet makes us the worst version of ourselves. It makes it okay for us to basically be the bonobo monkeys we claim that we're not.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I can see that. If you remove that veneer of civility where you have to face a person and interact on a certain level, if that's taken away and you can just say whatever you want and you're anonymous, mm-hmm. absolutely. I could see where that would be a horrible temptation for certain people to say exactly what is on their mind.
And then you start doing it in real life. There was a convention in Houston about a year and a half ago where somebody tore into one of the authors on a panel. Just like it was the internet. And
it
wasn't even her opinion. It was a friend of hers that couldn't make the con that she was asking for. And she got upset at the author because the author didn't do exactly what her friend wanted to do.
By the way, to redeem myself, Nikos Kazantzakis, he wrote The Last Temptation of Christ.
Excellent.
Sorry about that.
Speaking of the internet.
Exactly. Rush to the internet.
But the religion angle is good, though. I actually agree with
people
that.
People are very serious about their heroes.
These icons, and that's what they are, have you know, religion, and that's a study as well that they've done. We are becoming less and less religious. Certainly Americans, as a society, we're becoming less and less religious.
But we still believe in stuff.
Correct. And that's exactly where I was going with this. But that need is still there. The need for us to believe in something mm-hmm. greater than us, better than us, is still there.
And by
how do you deal with that?
By us, you mean the nerds, the geeks, these guys, right?
Well, no, everybody.
In general. Because my only argument to that, my only counter to that is that Republican nominees claim to be religious to get more votes because they know that there's a Christian majority out there.
Right. No,
so
that's not what I'm talking about. But
you said people are less religious. I think it's important to people. There are people out there who don't have that, or they fell out of it. And let's face it, someone can get so much joy and direction and uplifting emotion from a comic book. Doesn't that become just as important as the Bible, or just as important as the Holy Word that you can read and study and worship?
On a certain level, yes.
It does.
Yeah.
It really does.
On a certain level, it does.
Oh, somebody's going to quote this podcast out of context, and
But you know, there was
we're more popular than Jesus.
I just had an epiphany.
Shut up, John.
I just had an epiphany. Your analogy about the religion got me thinking about this, and there's another factor in play here that is real specific to the Captain America Hydra debate, but it also but it's really all the comics stuff, okay? And it's this. Comics have always been a cottage industry. I mean, when they used to not be, but in my lifetime, they have they've shrunk and they've pared down and they've become more and more of a cottage industry. And you know, whereas in the Golden Age, you know, you had books that routinely sold a million copies. Superman was a million copy book every month. Wiz Comics with Captain Marvel, a million copies a month. In fact, it outsold Superman. Batman, the same thing. This has been that way for a long time. The 70s was the last real heyday for these large number print runs. From the 80s on, the numbers have been steadily declining. And so from the time that I've been reading and going into comic shops, there was, you know, so basically, for, just to give you an example, in the 1980s and 90s, The Incredible Hulk was a mid-level Marvel book, okay? It sold right at around, and I'm paraphrasing here, if anybody wants to go look up the real numbers, you can. It sold right around 40,000 copies a month, all right? Now, that's 40,000 copies directly into comic shops where they were bought by 39,998 fans, okay? Now we have something and part of the membership to comics is that you are aware, you make yourself aware of the history of the character. If you say I like Batman, I'm going to start collecting Batman, you become aware either through immersion, self-study, or some other, you know, osmosis, you become aware of the history of Batman. And you know that he started, that he premiered in 1939, and you know that Robin came along the next year, and you know that there's been different versions of Batman and different versions of Superman, and this repository of knowledge is not unlike baseball stats for sports, okay? If you decide you're going to follow the Yankees, people are going to expect you to know about the Yankees, even the Yankees that aren't your team, even the Yankees that you don't know anything about, all right? This is accepted, and it's all through sports as we understand it. Comics has never done that before, but now, ever since 2000, ever since the first X-Men movie, we've had this extra thing that's happened. Fans of the movies who consider themselves Wolverine fans, they consider themselves huge Wolverine fans, but they've never read a Wolverine comic book before. Or if they read a Wolverine comic book, they read a few of their friends' comics, and yeah, you know what, I'll just stick with the movies. This is what this is the problem that we're having now. You've got
you see that with the Star Wars movies. Star Wars movies were never comics.
It always goes back to Star Wars.
Well, it's true because it's such a huge phenomenon that you see people taking this almost, you know, dogmatic view of these characters, and now of course there's supporting material. They've read the novels, they've done, you know, they've played the role playing games, they've read through the source books. And so yeah, it becomes you don't mess with our dogma. This is how it is. And when Disney announced that they were ditching the entire extended universe, again, oh my God, people were screaming and shrieking on social media, and you know, I'm sure they were issuing death threats and all that kind of stuff. But it's like, oh my God, that people really take this to heart. It becomes so important to them.
We were talking about artists, and I like that. When you frame it like that, there was an article that I read, and I think I posted it, about if we thought of them as artists, true artists, and said, I'm going to go into a museum and look at this Van Gogh, and it's beautiful. That's a beautiful Van Gogh. Someone else comes in, sees the same Van Gogh, and goes, God, why did he use those colors? I hate those colors. I would have used a different color. God damn it. Where is he? I'm going to kill him when he's already dead. But the point being, if you don't like the art, move on to the next painting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? We are seeing art. These guys are creating art. We can appreciate the art. We don't have to agree with the art. Why in the world is the scream Why does it look like that? If I were to do it, I'd put the hands over the mouth. That'd be much more effective, and it would be ironic. But no, you see, it's not up to us,
right.
Guys.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, I mean, Mark, you used the story about the Yankees, and I am not a sports guy at all. Less than a sports guy. I'm an anti-sports guy, meaning I go in the opposite direction. I just don't know anything about it. So this is going to be fun. But say a guy made a movie about the Yankees, and in his movie about the Yankees, Billy Dee Williams was a baseball player in real life,
right.
And he cast him, and he did something crazy, and then they hit the balls with wiffle bats, and they had a big song and dance, and whatever, they did something crazy.
I think you're thinking of the Bingo Long Traveling All-Stars at Motor
Thank
Kings.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Exactly what I'm thinking of. Yes, yes.
I thought maybe this was Major League the Musical.
No, right. No, it's me and Joseph having a little love nest. You just carry on,
yes.
Internet. We're fine.
Yes. But regardless, I think that baseball fans would be upset, and they'd be going, that didn't happen. That's not how it happened. Do you guys remember, let's take our hats off. You remember Batman 1984?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember walking into a comic book store shortly after it came out.
Oh, you mean the movie?
The movie.
Yeah, that was 88.
And a very helpful comic.
Or 89, sorry.
89.
The first one was 89?
Yep.
Yeah, I think so.
Right,
was it, guys?
89.
Mark?
Yep.
89. A very helpful comic nerd, let's go ahead and call him a nerd, we're all nerds, was very adamant that they miscast the Joker. I can't believe they cast the Jack Nicholson as the Joker. He's horrible. You know who I would have cast as the Joker? I would have cast Dick Van Dyke. He looks like the Joker.
What?
Yes, but, I mean.
He's 110.
That's not, even then, he was 110. I just, you know, that it's not a new thing.
No,
this,
no,
this,
no, definitely
not at all. It's just that now we have the platform. Now
yes.
We can do it. Everyone can hear it. Everyone's got a blog.
And, you know, it gets back to that then. It gets back to what Joseph said at the beginning, power. It is not so much that the reactions of some of these fans have changed or the vehemence. It's now they have a forum that they can jump onto, and it actually has an impact. They can send death threats to these creators via their social media websites and Twitter.
It has an impact. Someone comes and arrests them. You know.
Right, but no, I'm serious. Now they can now directly vent their rage to the point where it actually can reach the creator, whereas before, who cares? Who cares if some guy in Poughkeepsie was going, God, you know, I can't believe that they cast Jack Nicholson as Batman. Who gives a shit? Nobody cares what this guy says.
Yeah.
But now this guy can get on social media. He can find the writer or the director on Twitter. He can follow them. He can start posting vile, hateful shit. You know, the power, the access.
Yeah. But then there's a good side to this. I want to talk about that now.
Okay.
What benefits does a filmmaker or a TV show producer or whatever, a scriptwriter or showrunner, what benefits do they get from listening to fans? And I will bring up a wonderful example, Snakes on a Plane. Snakes on a Plane with Samuel Jackson. There was a fan uprising about Samuel Jackson in this movie, not in a bad way, but in a positive way. It looked so cheesy and so ridiculous, and the fans literally suggested the line, the infamous line, I am motherfucking tired of these motherfucking snakes on this motherfucking plane, because it was Samuel L. Jackson and he had to say it. It wasn't in the script.
Right.
They put it in the script because of the fans. Literally, the fans wrote parts of that movie. Now, does that make it better?
I think that I like where your head's at. I do. I think that there are times when the fans can be a positive thing. Certainly when we're talking about saving shows.
Right.
When we're discussing and not maybe just saving shows, but certain creators like having that access with their fan base,
yes.
and they get a lot of emotional support out of it,
mm-hmm.
and that's not everybody, and those are kind of, you know, unique circumstances. And by the way, it's one of the reasons why creative people use their real name on the internet and everybody else is Boba Fett 1974 or
right.
Luke 69 Leia at hotmail.com or whatever.
Yeah,
there's an image.
So, you know, that's the stuff that that's sort of one of the things that makes it not fair. There's a history of this. Star Trek fandom has always been very giving. The Starfleet fan club organizations are all 501c3 organizations that have a public service component where they do mm-hmm. charity fundraisers. The stormtroopers that are part of the 501st Stormtrooper Brigade, they all do public service stuff, which is great. Yeah. I think that, and I think part of this it comes out of our community. We found each other before the internet, and after the internet, initially the internet helped us connect with other people like us. That was one of the real big things where we saw the initial potential of the internet by realizing that we weren't the only people on the planet that liked the Buckaroo Banzai movie. Then there were chat rooms devoted to this and websites, right. And oh my God, we all thought John Big Boutte was funny, you know, and that there's a lot of power in that initial discovery of realizing you're not the only one that gets the joke. So yeah. I think that as forgive me for co-opting here, as an emotional touchstone, that's important. Those are good things,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, very much so. That's what saved Paramount was doing this lawsuit against the fan film, the fan Star Trek film, and J.J. Abrams, who I think is very in touch with the fans and is very aware of what the fans are saying on social media. Helped convince Paramount to drop their lawsuit against this fan-made film.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's a great thing. He understands that Star Trek fans are exactly like you described them, Mark, and that they're a close-knit community. They're very loyal, but they're really good people.
Right.
And J.J. Abrams realized there is nothing to be gained by isolating and antagonizing this wonderful group of people. So let's not do that.
Yeah, and so he talked
him out of it.
For the people who don't know why the lawsuit even existed in the first place when other people were making fan films, it has to do with copyright and your ability to say, I own this copyright. Because when it starts getting watered down by other people using it, a judge in future cases can turn around and say, well, you allowed this over here, therefore I'm not going to grant you this,
Yes, yeah. And that's also why
the business was so big into it with the mouse out.
Yeah, but part of it was also how it was funded. I mean, that was starting to – it's always about money. It always comes down to money.
Always.
So Paramount was very concerned that they were having very successful Kickstarters. And that was money that Paramount was not getting.
Right.
Yeah.
And even though this was a not-for-profit movie, they weren't going to make any money off of it. The amounts that were being raised were becoming alarming.
Yeah. And there were legitimate business reasons and legal reasons for them to pursue a lawsuit. They weren't just being meanies.
No, they weren't. I mean,
it's a lot of people don't realize
it's all business.
That,
so. Yeah, it's all business.
Yeah,
but still. I love the fact that J.J. Abrams talked them out of it. And, earlier on Facebook, Mickey had posted something about Game of Thrones, and I couldn't help but laugh. There was somebody left a comment on one of the episodes or something Mickey had said, basically saying, I think this about Game of Thrones, or I think that is just not – it's moving too slowly, and how dare they change this, and this is really done shoddily. And one of Mickey's friends posted, I've both written a better book and I've done a better TV series, but they've just never been released. Those losers.
He's actually one of the Lobot Lounge members.
Oh, good.
I love
a fan
that
of the
comment.
Show, so.
if you are hearing this, I loved that comment. You are fantastic. I want you to post that everywhere. Because, wow, that nailed it. Nailed it. Really, guys? Look. I know what it's like to try to write a book. It's really hard. I know what it's like to try to do a movie. You have to steer this gargantuan ship, and I'm even talking about a very low budget movie. So when artists are creating, and they are trying to give you their best work, I think actually most artists agree with Mark and fall in with Mark's philosophy of they're trying to give you their best work. Even folks like Zack Snyder are trying to give you their best work.
Yes.
This is what he thinks is a really great version of a vision for Superman and Batman and their first meeting.
Right. He's not phoning it in. No.
Yes. Exactly.
He's not a
hack. So if you Right. If you don't like it, that's fine. I totally respect that. You have every right to feel that way. Move on. Move on. You know, go home and put in your Blu-ray of Chris Reeves' Superman and watch it over and over
that
again.
That said,
that's okay.
I can understand some of the reasoning behind people, because while this is going on, they're not getting the Superman that they were hoping for.
Sure.
That'll probably happen in the future, but right now it's on hold.
Well,
absolutely. Yeah. And it's okay to be disappointed. That's the thing, is that people now, I forget who said that, you know, we're all just little special snowflakes now, and I'm kind of starting to agree with that, is that people think that they can't be disappointed or shouldn't be disappointed.
Right.
And you're going to be disappointed. You're going to be disappointed all the time.
Or that all this consumer culture, that some of it's not aimed directly into your pie hole, you know?
Right.
Some of it's over your shoulder, and some of it's not coming your way at all. And the fact that it's labeled Ghostbusters makes it, for some strange reason, such an irritant. And I've mentioned this before. I even wrote a blog about it, but I'm going to say this again. Anytime you feel that you're not going to get your money's worth from any movie or TV show or book that's out there right now, even if it's something that you have in the past loved, do yourself a favor and don't spend that money. And here's why. There's three reasons for this. One, life is too short to ingest material that you do not like. Two, if you are intentionally reading or watching something just to get upset so you can comment on it, you need to rethink some of your life choices, and you need to look at some cancer research. And I mean that sincerely. You know, you could poison yourself by just being a hateful person all the time.
I
and three, the strongest way in this current marketplace to send the message that you do not approve is not to get on social media and send a death threat. It is to not give them any money, because let me tell you something, my friends, all any of them care about at the end is how many dollars we're worth to them.
And certainly that's true of the big industry.
Yes.
I mean, you know, that may not be true for an individual artist, although money is important. But Hollywood's going to listen.
Hollywood,
if their huge blockbuster is a dud.
That's right.
Can I add a five?
Sure.
Here's my five.
All right, you got a five? Go.
I got a five. My five is this. What if you go to see this movie and it changes your mind?
Yeah.
That's never happened to Joseph.
Well, it's never happened to any of us, has it? Have we ever gone to a movie with a preconceived notion of, I'm going to hate this?
Yes.
Oh, this is going to
suck. Oh, yes. Yeah, I have.
And then you walk out going, not only was it not that bad, but, you know, I kind of liked it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What was yours? Mickey, what movie did you, or movie or property or TV or book or whatever, did you start and go, this isn't going to be good? And by the end of it, you went, that wasn't bad. In fact, I liked that movie or book or TV
show. Although I know what's happened, I can't remember because I haven't done it.
Because you're on your second Pangalactic Gargle Blaster, I told you.
I haven't done it in a theater. I've done it with, like, my wife going, we should watch this. And I go, ugh. Oh, actually.
Well, yeah, no, that's how it counts.
A good example, actually, would be Krampus.
No,
I wasn't against seeing Krampus. I wanted to see Krampus, but the way it was marketed seemed like a straight up, you know, you got to be in the right mood for that type of horror movie type thing. And it's actually this wonderful satire that strangely pairs well with Dennis Leary's The Ref.
Okay.
Oh, we love The Ref.
And they go great together, and it was a completely different experience of what I was expecting, and I love that movie. And I went into it going, I like it a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, mine was Deadpool. I had no interest in the character at all, zero. In fact, I would say I had negative interest. Every time somebody dressed up as Deadpool, I would roll my eyes. Every time I saw somebody cosplaying this, I'm like, whoa, my God, please stop. Do something else. That's not funny. It's not a great character. Right. I have no interest in this property. And then, of course, everyone started saying, you got to see the movie. I'm like, fine. And, oh, my God, we walked out, and Blythe and I were like, that is the funniest shit I've ever seen.
Ryan Reynolds.
And so long.
Even if you didn't know who Deadpool was because of all the, if none of the costumes existed at cons and all this other stuff like that.
Yeah, and
Ryan
and
Reynolds.
I knew very little about Deadpool, so I learned a lot when I went to go see the movie.
Right.
But, yeah, completely changed. Now I see people cosplaying as Deadpool, and all I can do is hear Ryan Reynolds' voice delivering some really snarky line, and I smile.
He's got the right idea. He wore the brown pants. Yeah.
Right.
Mark?
I'll go back in time just a little bit and mention Bryan Singer's first X-Men movie. When X-Men came out, we were flipped completely. Warner Brothers had successful superhero movies, but Marvel had yet to actually field one. Well, there was Blade, but nobody really counted Blade because I know he's got superpowers, but Blade is a vampire hunter hunting vampires. You don't have to explain that. That's not a secondary world.
And most people didn't know it was a Marvel character.
Well, right. That's my point, is that it required no explanation. Up until then, there was a terrible Punisher movie. There was a terrible Captain America movie with rubber stretchy ears. Nick Fury was being played by David Hasselhoff on TV.
Oh, Jesus.
Best role he ever did.
There was a ton of just mediocre, subpar, really terrible live-action Marvel things. And so I went to the X-Men with my arms folded, sitting there with a scowl on my face, daring Brian Singer. I double dog dare you. Say mutant one more goddamn time. You know, I was Sam Jackson in Pulp Fiction, holding a gun to Frank Whaley's head. You know, and guess what? Now it creaks a little bit, but at the time I was watching it, I couldn't believe that they pulled off Wolverine. I couldn't believe that they made Cyclops cool. And of course, the fans were all excited about Patrick Stewart. This is the problem with sidebar. This is the problem with fan casting. Okay, you guys either all get it wrong, so very wrong, because you complain about Michael Keaton and then you go, oh, he was really good. You complain about Ben Affleck and then you go, oh, he was really good. Or you pick something so obvious like, well, you know who should play Professor X? The bald actor that we already like. We can't shave anybody's head for this. He's got to actually be bald or he won't actually have sonic powers. All right, end sidebar. But nice. I came out of the X-Men flipped out. I was like, wow, this actually worked. I can't believe they made it all work. So I think we've all had those moments where,
I was very much against a movie called Cutthroat Island. I heard horror stories about it. I knew all about the making of it and the horrible reviews and the experience. So I said, that's probably one of the worst movies of all time. Well, I got really excited about all things pirates and decided to give it a shot, and I liked it. I liked it. There is nothing wrong with that movie. Really.
I don't know.
There's plenty wrong with the movie.
I respect your decision to enjoy it.
I enjoyed the hell out of it.
There's a lot of cool stuff
five.
About the movie and was poorly
that's
executed.
That's my number five, folks. Yeah. It's just, give it a shot.
Hey,
But that said,
because of Cutthroat Island, I had very low expectations for Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yes. Everybody did.
The Curse of the Black Pearl. And my lord, I walked out of that and I went, that is fantastic. What a great movie.
Yeah, I sort of had low expectations for Long Kiss Goodnight because it was Rennie Harlan and then, who also did Cutthroat Island, for those that don't know.
Yeah. And Sam Jackson.
And I love Long
Kiss Goodnight. Sam Jackson's got the best lines in the movie.
Yes.
You know?
And it's some great acting on his part, both him and her.
So for fandom, at this point in time, we are inundated. It's a beautiful time to be a fan. We're inundated. We've talked about this from all sides, for the most esoteric, obscure references to characters that we never would have imagined portrayed in real life. Gorilla Grodd. To see them and go, oh my God, that's brilliant. Yeah. And then the flip side, of course, is, wow, they got that wrong. Or, why did they make him that's not right. Or, it's not my Superman. That's okay, folks. Ultimately, we're all in this together. Let's all hold hands and sing Kumbaya. We can make this work. We can get past it. What we all have to realize is we all have a point of view. We all have opinions. And the art's not going to change. We can go and look at the art and appreciate it and go, yeah, not for me, but okay. Somebody did that. Nice.
Right.
It's not gonna rape your childhood, as the common phrase is.
Yeah.
And in closing, I wish to bring up one last subject.
You want to bring up Red Skull again, don't you?
He's at the very end. He's always at the very end.
Oh, God.
He's like, hail Hydra. He's always at the very end. I'm going to bring up Ghostbusters. Mark started it, yeah. And we haven't really dived into it. There has been such fan vitriol about this.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is, unfortunately, very misogynistic in its origin. And that upsets me more than anything else. Not because it doesn't look like a good movie, not because it doesn't look funny or entertaining, or it's because they're all women. And if you don't like the new Ghostbusters because they're all women, there's another problem. And I don't think it has anything to do with fandom.
Right.
You know?
No, and I agree. And specifically with Ghostbusters, it had that been just a reimagining of Ghostbusters, and it would, they were all, you know, Paul Rudd was one of them, and you know, Chris Evans, and you know, you had all these popular male actors in that role. I guarantee you, it would not be receiving the hatred that it is currently receiving. So there's no doubt in my mind that misogyny plays a part in the reaction to that movie. And again, as the father of an 11-year-old girl who loves comics and superheroes and the movies that I love and sci-fi, she saw the trailer and she just grinned from ear to ear. And she's so excited that they're girl Ghostbusters. Yeah. And that is so important to me. And so, yeah, to hear people before the movies, I mean, even on that trailer, which I didn't think was that bad, that first trailer came out, people were already declaring it like the worst thing since Ishtar.
Whereas, you know, I'm drooling over Holtzman.
Right. And I was like, okay, well, you know, I think it showed some promise. And then the subsequent trailer came out, and I'm like, that's going to be funny. This is going to be a funny movie. I'm so glad that they made it. I'm definitely going to go see it. But, yeah, it disappoints me. It, as a member of the nerd community, as we all are, it does disappoint me deeply when that segment of our fandom rears its ugly head.
And in addition to that, at the very beginning, when it was very first announced, we didn't have a cast. We didn't have, okay, we had like one cast member. We didn't have a script, anything, any idea of what was going on. We didn't know if it was a remake or what. At the very beginning, when they made the announcement that it was going to be all female Ghostbusters and their assistant's going to be a hunky guy, I cringed. Not because of that directly, but because I'm like, ooh, don't do that as a gimmick. Don't do that as a gimmick. And it's not a gimmick. As more stuff came out, it became very obviously not a gimmick and a labor of love. And
what makes it not a gimmick? What makes it not
a gimmick? Is when you're doing it to get like the Hell Hydra thing that everybody's talking about. A gimmick is when you do it and there's nothing else there. The gimmick is it.
It's a little gimmicky.
Well, it's a little gimmicky, but that's not the selling point. The reason,
no, sure.
The reason they're doing it is because they want to do it. He wants to work with these actors.
Well, sure. I'm gonna.
He has an idea for them.
I want to bring something up, and again, I'm going to be slightly contrarian, and you guys all know that I am publicly down with this movie. I love it. I'm excited about it. I love the actors in it. I love the director. I think they work well together. I don't have any problem with it at all. I really don't, and especially as a summer tentpole movie. But I need everybody to listen to me now and believe me later. This movie... there's two ways to have done a Ghostbusters movie, and they went the way that the fans didn't want to go. It's very hard to parse who's being a misogynist asshat and who is genuinely upset because the movie isn't, you know, up to snuff. And that's because nobody knows how to nobody understands rhetoric and nobody understands criticism. But that's neither here nor there. What we're really talking about here is this film is a remake, okay? Mm. Not a shot for shot script line by line remake, but it's absolutely a remake. The broad beats of the story are the exact same beats that are in the original movie, okay?
Right.
There's not going to be any surprises for us. If you've seen Ghostbusters and you're over the age of 40, you're not going to be surprised by this movie. That's not to say you won't be entertained, but it's not going to have the same jaw-dropping, stick-in-your-craw-afterward experience that the first one did, because it's not something new. Not only have you seen it before, but you've seen it multiple times since the age of, you know, since you were a teenager up until right now. This movie is a remake, and it's being made for a completely different audience.
Yes.
It's being made
like The Phantom Menace.
Well, yeah, in a sense, it's being made for the kids.
Yeah, but The Phantom Menace was
who were born after 9/11 and who don't consider movies made before the year 2000 to be a legitimate thing. You know, are kids who can't watch black and white. These are kids. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but no, I'm going to be the super contrarian here because this might be a movie that I walk out going, I had very low expectations, but hey, I loved it. I want that movie.
Right.
I really do. Yes. But I'll tell you guys, and I'm going on record right now, and I think I've even said it online, I'm not excited about it. It looks flat.
Yeah.
It looks gimmicky. It looks too – the humor is like, oh, yeah, we saw that coming. Oh, look, you know, the black subway worker is, you know, acting that way, and there's a geeky one, and then there's the wacky one, and there's a library ghost that looks like. Didn't we already do that? It seems – you're right. It is a remake, but it just seems so – dare I say unnecessary? I want to be changed. I want to come out, and I will see it, absolutely, because I love all those actresses. I think they're fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm excited about that.
Well, you know what I'm looking forward to? The sequel, because they're not going to remake Ghostbusters 2. Oh, hell no. We'll get something brand new there.
That would be nice.
Oh, come on, it even say, yeah, has a little musical at the end.
But the thing, I mean, since we're already doing, Hollywood is already doing remakes, this is how I think the Hollywood remake should be made. Exactly what they're doing with Ghostbusters. Rather than saying, hey, let's remake RoboCop and pretty much remake RoboCop.
Yeah.
Let's remake whatever. Pick whatever movie you want. Go to a classic. Let's remake The Three Musketeers and make it just like every other Three Musketeers.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd like to see somebody take a different approach, a different interpretation. If I were to hear tomorrow that they're going to do a brand new Sherlock Holmes movie, and it's going to be awesome, and it's going to be period, and Sherlock Holmes is a woman, I would be like, holy shit, I can't wait to see that.
Or James Bond. They're talking about a female James Bond.
Right.
Because how many more times do we have to see Sherlock Holmes interpreted as the way he's been interpreted? Let's look at a different version. Let's change up the sex, change up the racial identity, change up where they're at. I mean, do something to make it not be another Victorian.
I'm a huge Sherlock Holmes fan, and my favorite version actually is the modern interpretation because of everything they can do with it.
Are you talking about Elementary?
I'm sorry.
Cumberbatch.
I was going to say Elementary. I was going to say to a certain extent they did kind of do that with Elementary. Although Holmes is very much like Holmes, but he's still youthful and he's young. But Watson they made into an Asian female.
Yeah, she's awesome.
And she's awesome.
And we're big fans of Elementary.
Yeah, and it works.
I'll go with the BBC version.
I'm sorry, but the best Sherlock Holmes in modern era is the Zero Effect.
What's that?
Bill Pullman.
Bill Pullman.
Oh, everybody drink. I've stumped the panel.
No, you didn't stump me. I just haven't seen it yet.
Oh, okay.
The Zero Effect is this. Tell us. What?
Bill Pullman is in it, and he plays Daryl Zero, this whacked out, pill-popping genius of a guy. And the reluctant Watson character is played by Ben Stiller, who basically is his aide rather than any sort of help to him.
Well,
worth watching if you're sure. If you're a Holmes fan, the tropes are there. It's awesome, but it's a very fresh take. Now,
and the other fresh take of Sherlock Holmes, and it just popped into my head, was House.
Yes. Oh, right.
House was Sherlock Holmes.
First season, for sure. Absolutely.
His relationship with his buddy, the other doctor. Yes. I mean, Wilson. Sorry, you know. Wilson, yeah. I mean, that was Sherlock Holmes.
Absolutely.
He'd come in and he was eccentric. He was pill popping. He was crazy.
Cuddy was Lestrade.
Cuddy was Lestrade. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He was Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah. Well, you remember, Mark? I've told you that I've always wanted to do a version of the Three Musketeers, do a space opera.
Yes.
And these guys are basically hotshot star pilots, but again, they're not all male. they're some of the Three Musketeers are going to be female. D'Artagnan might be female, and she comes in as this hotshot star pilot in the middle of this galactic war.
Yes.
And, but it's the Three Musketeers.
That's exactly what
we get Shane Black to write it.
Oh, God, I wish. And, you know, again, that's another thing. Shane Black doing Doc Savage. I cannot tell you how excited I am. Shane, you're listening to this. I am such an admirer of your craft, of your talent. And there's people out there.
Want to get involved in the business.
Oh, he's amazing. Yeah. He's amazing. And by the way, I've met him in person. He's a wonderful and fantastic man. Very super smart. And there's already people complaining about the casting of The Rock.
Oh, yeah. People are into it, though. There's more people who like it.
Now, that's true. You know why? Because The Rock is so... I mean, Dwayne Johnson is just the most charismatic man on the planet.
I hope that Shane Black does a Daryl Zero on Doc Savage. I think that's what's needed.
Well, he already said. I mean, Dwayne Johnson has said that what he loves about Doc Savage and that what both he and Shane immediately clicked on was not that he's this amazing guy that can do all this stuff, but that he's a really weird dude.
Yeah.
And yes, he is. Doc Savage is a really weird dude.
And they are making it a period piece.
Oh, thank God, I cannot wait for this movie.
Whoa. It's going to be set in the 30s?
Yep.
I believe so. I believe it is a period movie.
Oh, Hera, help us. That's going to be amazing.
Yeah, Shane Black was very adamant about that.
Yeah. No, I cannot wait. So, I love when people take a classic character like that and then, again, either put a little bit of a spin on it, cast a little bit out of type.
Yeah.
The fact that Dwayne Johnson is... part Samoan, part black. I mean, it's like, who would have thought that would be who you were casting as Doc Savage?
Now, I would say we're excited about Doc Savage because we know the character, but he's not that well known in the main. So they can do something like that. They got a little attitude to cast, and we're like, oh, that's awesome. And people go, who? Yeah, sure. It's a Rock movie. It's called what? Doc? What? Yeah, sure.
Yeah, because we actually talked about this in the Superman thing. Could you imagine if they were going to do a Superman movie and they cast a black actor as Superman? There would be such an uproar.
But it would still be a better reaction than Nicolas Cage as Superman.
Let me finish this thought real quick because I know we're getting close to the end. I started this at the beginning and I'm gonna come back to
putting
it.
Chairs up, my friend.
I know. Well, this will be quick. Because of the influx of movies to the superhero universe, you now have exponentially more people who consider themselves fans of these characters than you do comic book readers who grew up reading these characters. And so what you have is a clash. You have a clash of type between the 100,000 to 150,000 fans who are reading Captain America every month and the tens of millions of Captain America fans who've never gone into a comic shop, who might have read some comics online but do not have the deep knowledge, okay? And part of what we've tried to do is be inclusive and say, hey, everybody's welcome at this table. But what the old fans are doing is saying, well, if you don't know the 80-year history of Captain America, you suck. And the movie people are going, why do we have to know? Why isn't it enough that I just like the character? Why can't I just like the character? You're oppressing my right to like the character. And oh, by the way, why can't he be black and be the Falcon? And the older fans are going, you don't understand. And they're going, no, you don't understand. And what's happening is we have two different groups who are cross-talking and not listening to one another to try and bridge those gaps. And so my message to you in closing, all right, nerds of the world, if you are a member of the Lobot Lounge, if you're a member of any of the fandoms that we love, my mission to you is this: preach inclusiveness, not exclusiveness. The world is too short and too ugly and too nasty right now for the thing that we love to be the thing that causes us to tear each other apart. We need to be bringing it together instead of pushing it aside. And if that mean, and sometimes that means that you're going to have to disengage from the conversation and walk away and go find something else. It ain't like there's a shortage of geek material out there, my friends. All right.
Okay. The bouncer is here. I have to hang on a second. He's not drunk. He's just passionate. Right. He's not drunk.
I'm fine. We're fine. Everyone's good.
Just back away. God, he's scary. Yeesh. I don't know where that guy came from. Mickey, any final words?
What Mark said was too important not to just say ditto.
Yeah. Aaron?
I will only add that if you want to complain about an artist's interpretation or creation, I encourage you, and I encourage everybody, period, to try and do something artistic and creative yourself. Write a short story, draw a picture, write a script, you know, try to do a short movie, whatever it is. Become artistic yourself, and then I think you will have a better appreciation for art that is presented to you. You'll be less eager to immediately judge that because you'll understand how much work and time and effort went into the creation of this art. Something as simple as a photograph or a quick sketch. That is skill, that is training, that is dedication. So I encourage everybody to do something creative. This weekend, decide I'm going to write a story. I'm going to draw a picture. I'm going to go out and take some photographs. Even if it's on your phone, I'm going to try to take a really pretty photograph and just see how difficult it is to do something like that. And I think when you come back to the things that you love, you will be. You'll have a little bit of emotional maturity, a little more emotional maturity, mm-hmm. and say, oh, yeah, I get it. I can't imagine what this person went through to try to create this beautiful work of art.
Nice. And nice. I'd like to follow that up with one thing. While teaching yourself and learning all this, find critics that are actually critics. Somebody who doesn't just tear the art form apart. Someone who isn't critiquing just so that they, you know, this is their job, they're supposed to tear everything apart. Someone who actually goes in and goes, okay, this didn't work because of this. They tried this, it didn't work. They tried this, it worked beautifully.
Constructive criticism. Right. Yeah.
Even destructive criticism, as long as it's actually a critique and not just, oh, well, that sucked. But put more eloquently.
All right, Maximilian is really angry, so we have to move. He's the bouncer, by the way. That is a scary robot. All right, Jesus Christ, he's hovering right over me, guys. All right, well, from the Lobot Lounge, we're wrapping this up, folks. In closing, I'll just I'll echo the words of our favorite pan-universal traveler and brain surgeon, Buckaroo Banzai. I'll say, hey, folks, don't be mean. There's no cause to be mean, because remember, no matter where you go, there you are. And Red Skull lives. Good night.
Did anyone else think he was going to go, no matter where you go, Red Skull lives?
Almost.
Hey,
I'm going to edit it together like that.
Respect the quote.
I want to hear the quote.
Gentlemen Nerds is a production of Cloak & Dagger Studios, LLC. Music by Ben Gibbs. The sound editor is Michael Ashley Finn. Web design and cloakanddaggerstudios.com by Rustix Interactive.
Promotional consideration by Steve Rogers for President campaign.
Can we make Maximilian the official bouncer of the Lobot?
I love that.
That's terrifying. That the image is horrifying.
I almost started doing the.
No! We're going.
And the little droids are the ones that bust the tables.
Mm-hmm. There you go. The ones that look like little trash can lids.
Yeah, Bob's our waitstaff.
Yeah.